This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. How Sound is a production of PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. PRX launched a new podcast recently. It's called Offshore. It's about Hawaii, the island paradise, right? Well, have a listen. As the host of Offshore says, you'll be surprised how messy paradise can be. Like I said, it's brand new and I'm already hooked. Offshore from PRX. How Sound is co-produced by Transom, a resource for audio storytelling and reporting. Transom is accepting applications for its spring radio storytelling workshop on Cape Cod. Visit transom.org for the details. On this episode of How Sound, a story dissection. I'll pull apart a story step by step to show an incredibly common but effective way to organize a story. It's an episode from 99% Invisible, which of course is kind of meta. 99% Invisible is a podcast about design. Get it? Anyway, the story is called Half a House, and it's a really good one. One of my faves, actually, of the last few 99% has produced. Half a House is an excellent example of a storytelling structure called the E. That's a lowercase e, not a capital E. I'll try to describe it this way. A story has a timeline, plot points. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, and so on. You could draw it as a straight line with dots on it, and each dot is a plot point. As the producer of a story, you get to start the story wherever you want on that timeline. You could start at the very beginning. You could start at the very end. Typically, though, stories often start in the middle somewhere, at a point on the timeline that sparks a listener's interest with some tension and maybe a surprise, where there's a character facing a problem. Then after establishing that moment in the story you're telling, often what will happen is this. The story goes back in time, usually to the beginning. It's a way to provide context and background for the moment that just opened the story. Now, let's get back to the E if you're following this. Imagine that straight line again. If you start your story with action at some point in the middle of that line, then move to the beginning, picture connecting those two points on the line. In other words, like, curl up the beginning of the line until it touches the point in the narrative where you started. It would look something like a lowercase e, a kind of loop. It might be a small loop or a big loop, but a loop nonetheless. That structure, I can't even begin to tell you how frequently it's used, that structure is so universal because it works. And to prove it, let's dissect that story from 99% Invisible. Again, it's called Half a House, and here's the opening.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. The night of February 27th, 2010, Luis Enriquez was getting home from his job at a lumber factory in Constitución, Chile.
Eso de las tres de la mañana. Tres de la mañana.
It was around 3 in the morning. I was watching TV with my wife and a neighbor, and all of a sudden, we started feeling the earth shake. And it was just getting stronger and stronger and stronger to the point that we couldn't stand up.
Producer Sam Greenspan, translating for Luis.
Luis was in an earthquake, a bad one. When the shaking finally stopped, he was relieved to see that his wife and their two kids were all fine. But Luis knew they were still in danger.
Because in Chile, everyone is taught from childhood that after an earthquake hits, the first thing you do is get to higher ground.
Which is what Luis and his family did. They got in their car and they sped to the top of a nearby hill. From its peak, Luis could look down from the hillside to where the River Maule met the Pacific Ocean. You could see it happening. You could see it super clearly. You could see the waves coming into the city.
This is a classic start to a story. Roman and Sam begin with Luis and an earthquake, a character and his problem. There's also a sequence of events, an anecdote. This happened, and this happened, and so on. And it all makes for an excellent first image in the story, a really good one. It's very visual. The first thing the listeners see is an earthquake and a family watching an approaching tsunami. I'd call this scene 1A if I was diagramming the story. For scene 1B, Sam and Roman stay with the earthquake in Constitucion, but they zoom out from Luis.
The earthquake that Luis is describing was tremendous, a magnitude 8.8, the second biggest that the world had seen in the past 50 years. The quake and ensuing tsunami completely crushed the seaside town of Constitución, Chile, where Luis lives. By the time it was over, more than 500 people were dead, and 80% of the city's buildings were ruined.
As part of a relief effort, an architecture firm called Elemental was hired to create a master plan for the city, which included new housing for people displaced in the disaster.
But the structures that Elemental delivered were a radical and somewhat controversial approach towards housing.
They gave people half a house.
Nice hook, right? You immediately want to know what the heck is half a house. In fact, just as a side note, they do this a few times in the story. They land the ending of a scene or a section of the story in a way that propels you forward. You want to know what happens next. In this case, I don't know about you, but I want them to answer my question. What's a half a house? And they do. I'd argue this is scene 1C.
Picture a simple two-story home with a pitched roof. A square with a triangle on top. Basically how a kid would draw a house. Only in these, there's a wall that runs down the middle, from the peak of the roof all the way to the ground, splitting the house in half.
One side of the house is finished, and the other side.
Y lo por completar el lado izquierdo.
The other side is a completely empty space. There's a roof and an exterior wall, but the rest is just an open void.
The architecture firm behind these houses, the Santiago-based Elemental, has made a name for themselves building these half a homes. And not just as disaster relief, either.
To date, Elemental has done about 10 low-income housing projects across Chile, all designed so that the homes would be largely unfinished when the residents moved in.
And the response from the architectural community has been immense. In 2016, the firm's founder, Alejandro Aravena, was awarded the Pritzker Prize, the top prize in architecture.
In their jury citation, the Pritzker Architecture Prize said that, quote, Alejandro Aravena epitomizes the revival of a more socially engaged architect, especially in his long-term commitment to tackling the global housing crisis and fighting for a better urban environment for all.
This for building disaster victims and other poor people unfinished homes.
Roman and Sam deftly segue away from the earthquake to talk about how the housing crisis after the earthquake in Constitución was addressed with unfinished homes. And they zoom out even further by telling us about unfinished homes throughout Chile and how they're a big thing in the architecture community. In other words, they let us know there's a trend and the houses are highly regarded among architects. It serves as a little bit of context for the houses and it kind of sells us on them. So if I was to diagram this story, I'd say we just finished scene one and it has three parts. Luis and the earthquake, Constitución and the earthquake, and a brief overview of the housing provided as part of the relief effort. Now, getting back to the E, this is one big plot point on the timeline. It's the moment when there was an earthquake and a radical housing was provided. I suppose you could say it's two plot points, first the earthquake, then the housing that followed. Now, the story goes back in time. This is where the E takes shape, the loop. The story moves from 2010 to the 1970s.
To understand where these half-built houses came from, you have to understand them as an attempt to solve the problem of global urban migration.
Over the past several decades, people the world over have been migrating from the countryside to cities.
The draw of the city was creating this problem. So the result is squatting.
This is George Gattoni, an architect who grew up all around Latin America, mostly in El Salvador. George saw firsthand what happens when a population outgrows its supply of buildings.
The housing deficit of San Salvador, the capital, was something about 10,000 units a year and growing. The backlog of people that had no services, it was unbelievable.
George wanted to help solve this problem.
This scene isn't over, but I wanted to stop and point out something. Sam isn't just dumping a bunch of history on us. He's telling us a story. He's found a character who not only provides some of the background on the origins of half-built houses, but they have a story. There's a little narrative here, a sequence of events where a character attempts to overcome a problem. Okay, back to the scene.
George wanted to help solve this problem.
But I was struggling with how to make a house affordable.
In the 1970s, George heard about a new master's program at MIT.
A program called Urban Settlement Design in Developing Countries.
At MIT, George found a mentor and a professor named John F.C. Turner.
So John F.C. Turner, a British urban planner, was spearheading this idea that people can build for themselves.
In a 1972 essay called Housing as a Verb, Turner made the case that housing ought not be a static unit that is packaged and just handed over to people. Rather, housing should be conceived of as an ongoing project wherein residents are co-creators.
And from this thesis, Turner helped promote an idea.
This idea that was emerging, this sites and services idea.
Sites and services, also sometimes called incremental building. It basically means instead of building people completed homes, governments should just build the key parts of a home that people have the hardest time building on their own, like concrete foundations, insulation, plumbing, electrical wiring.
And then get the government to provide services to those sites.
Roads, drainage, sewers, or pit latrines, whatever the case may be. Garbage collection, you've got to route your trucks to the schools.
Thus, gradually over time, people start to turn their basic sites into suitable housing with materials they source themselves on their own terms.
What people have to donate of their own is labor, the cost of labor.
And the cost of materials to expand. But in the end, they own what they build. It's their investment.
They have the ability, and governments cannot build as well as quickly and in a way that makes sense to these households.
Since finishing his studies at MIT in the 1970s, George has done these kinds of incremental building projects all over the world, in Latin America, Kenya, Indonesia. And these projects can take different forms. Sometimes it's just giving people a concrete pad with utility hookups. Sometimes it's just giving people a one-room house with a kitchen and bathroom and the expectation that they'll build extra rooms onto it.
It sounds odd, but believe me, it works.
That's the end of scene two. Well, actually, it might be scene 2A, because the next segment is a continuation of the background on incremental housing. The story shifts from a global view to a focus on Chile. So yeah, let's call that last scene 2A. Here's 2B.
These ideas that George Cotoni and his contemporaries at MIT pioneered, that governments can support people building for themselves and then let them own what they build, began to spread through the developing world.
And so when the architecture firm Elemental got their first commission to do low-income housing in Chile, they took the ideas from incremental housing as points of departure.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't create the idea. Actually, we import that. To make something that can be improved by time.
This is Juan Ignacio Cerda, one of the principal architects at Elemental. Cerda told me that in 2002, Elemental got a commission to build 100 units of low-income housing in a city in northern Chile called Iquique.
And they had to deliver it on a tight budget.
$7,500 unit.
With only $7,500 allocated per household, the most straightforward and cost-effective way to house all 100 families was to cram everyone into big block-style apartments.
When they hear, what about blocks? They said, if you dare to propose a block, we start a hunger strike, because it's the worst thing ever.
According to Juan Ignacio Cerda, the community threatened a hunger strike because an apartment block would be extremely limiting. Sure, they were living in a slum before, but at least they had control over their own space. They could make expansions and adjustments when they wanted to. But with a block-style housing project, they'd be confined to a small, static space.
Which is worse, because you are not able to expand the house.
And so what Elemental came up with were tall, rectangular houses separated by empty space.
Each unit was just big enough to meet Chile's minimum standards for low-income housing. And then the residents could, on their own time, however they wanted, expand into the empty space adjacent to their home.
Elemental spent the early 2000s iterating on this concept, building homes that just met the basic legal requirements for low-income housing in Chile, but with room to grow.
I want to return to the E. Think about the timeline of this story. Not how it's being told, but the events as they actually happened. In the early 1970s, the idea for incremental housing was born. The idea was tried out. It worked. It spread. It even made its way to Chile. This happened, then this happened, then this happened. Then in 2010, earthquake. Constitución is devastated. Thousands of people lose their homes. Incremental houses were built in response. Okay, that's the timeline, but that's not exactly how they told the story, right? Sam and Roman started, as you know, with Luis and the earthquake and the idea that the housing crisis was solved with half-built homes. Then they went back in time to the 1970s. By doing that, by making that leap in time, they started the loop in the lowercase e. And ever since in the story, they've been leading us back to the point where they started. We're now in Chile. We've seen that Chile has adopted incremental housing throughout the country. Next, Sam and Roman fully connect the loop, bringing us back to Constitución and telling us just a little bit about what we already know. Half-built homes were erected in the town. That finishes the circle in the E. But quickly, they move the story forward, giving us details about those houses. Imagine the E again. This is the part that extends past the loop.
And then in 2012, after the earthquake in Constitución, Elemental got a commission to help create a new master plan for the city, which included creating a new neighborhood full of incremental buildings.
It would be located on one of the tallest hills in the city and would be called Villa Verde.
Okay, we are on our way up to Villa Verde and Constitución. Oh, wow, here it is. This is it right here? Wow, oh, it's really big.
Sam went out to see Villa Verde with producer Martina Castro.
Yeah, should we drive around first?
Yeah. To get to Villa Verde, you drive straight up one of the tallest hills in Constitución. You pass a traditional-looking apartment complex, also built to house people after the 2010 quake. Once you're on top of the hill, you get some just staggering views of the town, the ocean, and the River Maule below.
It's like a whole bunch of these little boxes on a hillside. Looking over, that's the River Maule.
Villa Verde is made of neat rows of simple two-story houses. Half of each house is identical. Same windows, same color, kind of a farmhouse red. The other half of each house, though, is completely different. They have different doors, different windows, or pieces of tarp where windows will go. And in some houses, half the house has nothing there at all.
It's just like half the house is missing. And then there are plenty of houses that people have built out.
When people get their houses, the side that comes pre-built is pretty bare bones. The walls are unpainted sheetrock, and the floors are unfinished concrete and plywood. The kitchen comes with just a sink, no stove, no refrigerator, no cabinets. The houses are Spartan, to say the least, but they are habitable, practical, and well-insulated.
That was scene 3A, Villa Verde. Here comes scene 3B, the return of Luis. The story continues to move forward with details on how to build the second half of the house, with Luis as the character.
Martina Castro and I spent a couple of days walking around Villa Verde, talking to residents, and it's there that we met Luis Enriquez, the earthquake survivor we heard from earlier.
Somos un programa de radio de Estados Unidos. ¿Podríamos pasar?
Sí. Hello.
When we met him, Luis and his wife were outside, working on a gravel walkway to their home. Luis invited us in. Martina translates.
So when you moved in, what were the most important things that you wanted to do right away?
Cuando se mudaron, ¿cuáles eran las primeras cosas que querían hacer?
Ampliar, porque igual era reducido. Entonces la idea era ampliar para poder estar cómodos.
Yeah, just make it bigger because it was a really small space, so we had to build it out to be comfortable.
With help from his wife and his brother, who also lives in Villa Verde, Luis laid concrete on the empty side of the house to make a floor and put up exterior walls and flooring for the second story. None of them had really done construction before, but they had direction from workshops on building techniques that Elemental helped facilitate.
The homes also come with a user manual with directions for how to expand the house. And expansions can be done with standard size building materials, so residents don't have to pay lots of money for custom cut pieces of lumber.
So far, Luis has focused his efforts on just getting the house to be big enough to accommodate his family. And so inside, the walls are still unpainted. The downstairs floors are still just unfinished concrete, and upstairs it's unfinished plywood. Luis knows they've got a long way to go on their home.
But he doesn't just see the bare walls and coarse floor. He sees what it all can become.
If and when the Enriquez family does have tiling and carpet and paint and baseboard on the walls, it'll be way nicer than anything that they ever could have afforded on their own, or what they could have normally gotten through state-funded low-income housing programs. And so now, Luis is the owner of a four-bedroom home that keeps out the cold, won't get flooded, and won't fall down in an earthquake.
Tanto yo como mi señora tuvimos una vida difícil.
You know, my wife and I, we've had tough lives. So finding out that we were going to be owners of our own house was just incredible.
Scene 3C is kind of a bucket of information based on Sam's reporting. The story zooms out from Luis and takes a look at what other people are doing in the neighborhood.
Not everyone I talked to at Villa Verde was enthusiastic about having to build their own home, and some thought Elemental's contractors could have done a better job. But for the most part, people there seemed really happy with their homes, even people who hadn't expanded theirs at all. One resident, a single mom named Camila Hernandez Rodriguez, hadn't made any additions yet.
Yeah, so of course, you know, one dreams and you think that you're going to just have everything ready all at once. And so I wanted to, you know, build out the house and everything. But then I just focused on doing small things first, because obviously I couldn't do that right away.
Most people in Villa Verde are further along with their expansions than Camila, and everyone seems to have some project or another. Some residents have even opted to use their extra space to start businesses, like little stores that sell bread and candy and cell phone minutes. The feeling I got from residents is that they felt invested in Villa Verde. They like living there and they felt safe.
Okay, I think the story could end right here. Luis's problem is resolved. We have what seems like a full picture of half-built homes in Constitución, Chile, and the world. I'm sure there's more Sam and Roman could tell us, but I'm satisfied. I get it. Arguably, maybe a moment of reflection could be tagged on here. Someone talking about housing and home ownership writ large. But if the story ended here, I'd say, okay, fine. But it doesn't. And I really like what happens next. Sam and Roman bring it home. No pun intended. They pose a logical question for 99% Invisible's mostly American audience. What about the U.S.? Smart.
Why haven't we seen this approach in the U.S.?
I don't think this could work in the U.S. There's a lot of things going on here which are really innovative, and there's a lot of things where things could go wrong.
This is Dr. Jennifer Stoloff, a researcher with the consulting firm Econometrica.
Before that, I was a social science analyst at HUD in the Office of Policy Development and Research for about 14 years.
Dr. Stoloff is an expert at evaluating government programs, particularly those that pertain to housing. She's also an historian of public housing in the U.S. I told Dr. Stoloff about the Villa Verde project and sent her some pictures, and she says, yeah, it does kind of align with the U.S. ethos of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
It is very bootstrappy. It's true. But it's also very risky. I mean, and I mean in a safety way, not just in a financial way. It is both.
First off, someone could get hurt building out their house, which means you'd have to deal with both a medical and a legal emergency.
In the States, you know, there'd be litigation issues, right? I mean, if you were working, building your floor or ceiling, and you fell down in the States, maybe you would sue the developer.
But for Dr. Stoloff, the biggest hurdle to an incremental building project working in the U.S. isn't a matter of safety or legality.
It would be an embarrassment, right? So the United States of America can only build poor people half a house? We would be ashamed of ourselves. Even though, in fact, that might end up providing way more people with adequate housing at the end of the day. But we couldn't do it. It's like we'd lose face.
Because unlike Chile, the United States does have the money. And perhaps also unlike Chile.
We don't like to spend money on poor people. We think everybody should be able to find their own way out of poverty. And it's just not true, but that is the expectation. And we are not in a scarcity economy, and we could afford to give people an entire house.
But by and large, we don't.
And here comes the final scene, the moment of reflection I was looking for earlier.
For the U.S., it's not a matter of scarcity. It's a matter of values.
Elemental, however, has come to see scarcity as a tool which Juan Ignacio Cerda finds vital.
I'm sure that in the States, everything have rules and controls, so you don't leave room to all those new things that came up from the Latin world. That obviously comes from scarcity.
So if you were doing this project in Constitucion, and let's just say at the very last minute they go, okay, we're going to double your budget, would you then have made everyone full houses?
I don't know. That's, I've never happened. And
theoretically, if money wasn't a restraint, would you still want to build the way you do?
It's a good thing to deliver a whole house, but if you give me double the money, I keep the house as it is, and I improve with all that money the public space surrounding the house, the neighborhood.
Providing the infrastructure that people can't provide themselves, like parks and libraries and public transit, is at the very root of the sites and services approach. Building half a house might be the best way to make a community whole.
Boom. There you have it, an excellent example of the E story structure. If you've not heard of this structure before, I swear you're going to start seeing it everywhere. Newspaper and magazine articles employ it all the time. Radio stories too. Even a friend telling you a story over a beer. Oh man, you won't believe what happened today. This and this and this. But wait, let me back up and tell you how this all came about. There's the loop, and your friend takes you back to where they started, and then they say, so what did I do in response? They move the story forward past where they began with more plot points along the timeline. The E, put it to work for your next story. Thank you, Sam and Roman of 99% Invisible. Thank you for letting me take a knife to half a house. If the E interests you, you might also want to listen to an episode of How Sound called My Kingdom for Some Structure. Producer Bradley Campbell runs through a few common story structures. He's even drawn them out on napkins. You can see them and hear the episode at transom.org. I recently read some reviews of a podcast. They said things like, expertly produced, always fascinating, stories are told in a way that grips you. This is the podcast I've been waiting for. Well, what podcast is it? Outside, from PRX and Outside Magazine. Sound-rich, compelling stories about the outdoors. Subscribe to Outside wherever you get your podcasts. This is How Sound, the backstory to great radio storytelling. Hats off to John Barth, my guru at PRX. I'm taking my hat off a second time to WCAI in Woods Hole for use of their studios. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks for listening.
From PRX. And transom.org.